The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We're on the cusp of a once-in-a-generation opportunity, a wealth transfer that occurs when assets get very, very inexpensive. And the question is, do you have liquidity in the most reliable form? And yes, that does mean devoid of counterparty risk. That's imperative. And if you can answer those questions, I think the next 3-4 years are absolutely thrilling for you instead of terrifying.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I remember the first time I played musical chairs. Honestly, I really do. I remember the scene because it was such an unusual game to me. You know, here we were. I was in kindergarten. There probably were 12 kids and the music starts. And these 12 kids, and I was included in that, circled these chairs that were in the center of a circle. And there were 11 chairs. 12 kids, 11 chairs. And of course, we all know how the game goes when the music stops. Every kid, all 12, try to find a chair. There's only 11 chairs. There's one kid left standing. Then you play the game again. You remove the kid, you pull a chair out, and you do that over and over and over. And that's how the game's played. Dave, the reason I'm bringing this up is because for years, we've talked about how the gold paper market is a lot like the game of musical chairs. At one point, there were 100 players and only one chair. Earlier this year, there were 300 players and only one chair. But the statistic right now is just blowing my mind. How many players, Dave?
542-1, which puts it at all-time high. If you're looking at registered owners versus the physical inventory held there at COMEX. And an interesting article by Byron King from the Daily Reckoning, which was reprinted in Business Insider. And I think it's just worth thinking about. The normal game of musical chairs is where there's only a minor deficiency. You know, again, 11 chairs, 12 players.
Right, right.
This is the opposite way around. And so, and in this article, they provided the updated numbers for the ounces available on COMEX. And as you say, you know, we've always considered 100-1 a very big deal. And in terms of musical chairs, it's really not much of a game to have one chair and 100 players, unless you're a spectator, because if you're a spectator, it's like mixed martial arts or something. I mean, if you fancy brawling, then that's what you have with those kinds of ratios. Well, the numbers soared in recent years, as you mentioned, to 300 claims, and that was as inventories dropped. And now we have not only new entrants into the paper gold market, but we also have the inventories which have declined, not been increased significantly. So the ratio has exploded. The March numbers, registered owners, those with a claim to the gold, 542 versus the ounces available in the COMEX depositories, 1. And as Byron says, your child has 30 times better odds of applying and getting admitted to Harvard, Yale, and Stanford than does a COMEX contract holder of walking away with 1 ounce of gold.
Well, you know, and the key is, of course, in any musical chairs game, if you don't want people to find out that there were fewer chairs, you have to keep the music going. That's the key. You can't stop the music or lift the needle, so to speak.
Well, we suggested a run on the London vaults a few weeks ago, and COMEX is the same here in the States. It's not if. That's not the question. It's when you see the price of gold and silver move up, say, $100, not in a week, but in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a new experience for most investors to see the supply and demand disparity in the physical market play itself out in an exponential move in the price.
Well, and this has been going on for a while. I mean, let's face it, for the last 10 or 15 years, they've been able to keep the music going to a degree. We haven't seen what you're talking about, but at some point, the music has to stop.
The dynamics are there, and I think the trust factor has been eroded for the last 10 or 15 years. And so when confidence, which is a very critical variable, when that's shattered, then you see the mad dash begin for who can secure what. And it's not at the market price, it's at any price.
Mm-hmm.
And my suggestion is you don't buy when you need to, because by that time it's too late. We were discussing the other day just triathlon-related things, and we've got our big race coming up here in about 3 weeks. And the reality is you need to fuel your body before your body tells you what you need.
Right.
You fuel when you feel fine so that you continue to feel fine. And sometimes, you know, when you're trying to meet a need, when that need is obvious, it's tougher to do that. Anticipation. That's the operative word here. Anticipation is key. Asia has already done that. China and India taking major stocks of gold off of the market. Interestingly enough, Texas may be doing that as well in terms of a work of anticipation. Be ahead of the curve, not behind it.
Well, and I'm wondering if there are a lot of people who are already starting to see this break in confidence, because ETF buying of gold, okay, tonnage of gold in the exchange-traded funds usually goes down when the price of gold goes down. You know, people get scared, they liquidate, but in this particular case, over the last few weeks, gold's dropped, what, 1.5% roughly, and the tonnage on the ETFs has increased pretty substantially.
Well, the normal behavior over the last 4 years has been on anything that would represent good news for gold, the price goes down. And on anything that represents bad news for gold, the price goes down.
Hmm.
And so it didn't matter, good news or bad news, the price was going to go down. And a lot of the negative movements, a lot of liquidations came from exchange-traded funds. So give them an excuse and they would be liquidating. The exchange-traded funds give you the ability to buy a proxy for gold and have it, you know, in a London vault. I'm not sure that I necessarily want it in the London vault. Might want to rather have that in my hand. But the issue is this. What we're talking about is the price is now in decline, or has been over the last couple of weeks, after reaching a peak, was it May 5th, just above 1300. And it's been in decline, and yet the tonnage in the ETF has expanded every day.
Yeah. So obviously somebody's buying.
Yeah, exactly. You said about a 1.6% decline. Bloomberg covered this, and the ETF in that same time frame added about 63 tons. So the sentiment in the gold market has shifted. Institutional investors are basically saying, well, maybe as long as there's this interesting, curious, unexplainable experimentation going on with monetary policy, whether it's Japan, Europe, the United States, maybe, just maybe, because we don't know the consequences, it makes sense to have a little bit of a gold exposure. I'm on the way to work this morning listening to National Public Radio, which sometimes I do. Don't know why, sometimes. but sometimes it's interesting. And, you know, I'm listening to the tale being told about George Soros having bought 20 million shares of Barrick gold. And, you know, Paul Singer recently advising a huge amount of gold. Of course, he's the manager of about $28 billion hedge fund. And we talked about Druckenmiller, who doesn't manage other people's money anymore, but for his own account, felt it necessary.
There have been big names coming into the gold market.
About a third of his liquid assets are in physical gold. So it's an interesting shift amongst the bigwig crowd, and you have to wonder why. And I think for the bigwigs, it makes sense. But what you end up seeing is copycat trades, and I think you're going to see that for the next 2 or 3 years, where people say, oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean,
everybody's doing it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you look at the stock market, we've gone 7 years without a major correction. Without a major correction. Mm-hmm. And I mean, anymore, you turn on CNBC and a major correction is when it's down 0.5%. And everyone's literally crying and there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And oh my word, can you believe we're 4% off an all-time high? This is really tough going. But when you think about not having a major correction for 7 years, that's the second longest winning streak in stock market history. And then when you look at valuations being the second highest in all of stock market history, when you look at earnings, which again, we've talked about GAAP versus non-GAAP earnings, positive if you're looking at non-GAAP, down 15% if you're looking at GAAP earnings.
Well, and non-GAAP is lying, and GAAP is telling the truth, as far as the government accounting procedures, right?
GAAP is the generally accepted accounting principles. And yeah, so we see a declining trend in earnings across your S&P 500 companies. We've been in an industrial recession for at least 6 months. We've got retail numbers, which are coming out, which suggests that we are solidly in a recession. You've got the political machinations, which suggest when you look at the extreme left and right, the appeal of a Sanders and the appeal of a Trump, you know, where it really is middle America, whether you're conservative or liberal, saying something's not adding up right now. I'm angry because the economy is no better than it was, and I don't think it's going to be getting any better anytime soon. And they would be very upset if you said, no, 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 it's actually much better, because their own stories suggest something different. And it doesn't matter if the stock market's up, they weren't participating. You look at the first quarter, you look at the second quarter, and again, it's a declining trend in the earnings of companies, but there's not a huge decline in the stock market. Earlier this year, we discussed the industrial recession. That was the obvious sore thumb in the first quarter. And we asked whether it would remain contained in that sector of the economy or if it would spread. And it appears that it has spread to retail. You've got a retail recession, ironically, which is coming as official statistics are telling us that consumer spending is on the rise. Now, I mean, we'll talk about that in just a minute. We do know that consumer credit has expanded. That is some evidence that there has been an increase in spending. But retailers have not been on the receiving end. This is kind of an interesting scenario where the official statistic for retail sales is on the increase, but retailers are suffering greatly. Kohl's disappointed on their earnings. Their CEO has said there seems to be some macroeconomic issues given the performance of both ourselves and the competition on the recent conference call. That's what he was saying. Dillard's missed on their earnings. So you've got Kohl's, Dillard's, Macy's was off. And Macy's is sitting there scratching their heads, their management is, over how the economy, if it's recovering, how is traffic falling off at all their stores so sharply?
Well, and they're probably not scratching their heads. They're probably shaking their heads saying, you know, here goes the government again on an election year, giving statistics that are just, they're coming up with them out of thin air, Dave.
Well, and they may be saying to themselves, look, Amazon may capture market share from all of us. Brick and mortar may be dead, where everything is ordered on a virtual basis.
Or the weather. Remember how they blame the weather, right?
Well, and that was the case. Last year, in the first quarter, we had really ugly numbers. And it was like, look, you know what? It's been an extraordinarily cold winter, and that explains everything. And yet, we just had the warmest winter on record. The warmest winter on record.
So you can't use it as an excuse this time.
You can't use it as an excuse for the retailers to be suffering. Nordstrom's missed on their earnings. You got Macy's, Kohl's, Dillard's. I'm just saying that it's not one company. It is retail. And when Nordstrom's lowered their guidance for the next quarter, their shares fell 15% on the announcement. But here's the interesting thing. You've got all the bad news in retail stocks. And yet Friday, retail sales were up an impressive 1.3%.
According to who?
Well, the Bureau, of course.
I mean,
it's curious because if the number was legitimate and the news really is that good, why did we see Treasuries rally on the same day of the announcement?
Well, and I think you should explain that because the Treasuries rally typically on bad news, not on good news.
That's right. People buy Treasuries on bad news, not good news. And this is where, again, simple adages, the devil's in the details.
Right.
It appears that the seasonal adjustment number for the retail sales figure was way out of line compared to the last several years. Stephanie Pomboy of Macro Mavens pointed out that had the same adjustment been made as had been made over the last several Aprils, you know, same, in terms of the seasonal adjustment, we would have had a 0.9% decline in retail sales instead of a 1.3% positive gain. You see? By the way, labor markets are also on the mend, right? Official statistics, you look at U3, that statistic has stabilized. We've got unemployment at 5%. So the labor markets, we can assume, are pretty healthy. It's been advertised that wages are coming back and are increasing. And yet, also from last week, the Fed's internal numbers, this is the labor market conditions index, for April, it was down 0.9%.
So for their own private numbers, they actually are showing negatives. For the public numbers, they're showing positives, is what you're saying.
Who's the audience?
Yeah.
Who is the audience?
Well, who are the voters?
So we have the fourth consecutive negative reading on the labor markets conditions index, which the Fed uses as one of their critical measures. And we haven't had a string of negative readings on that particular index, that long of a string of negative numbers, since the global financial crisis. So, and this is the one that they trust. Right? It's just interesting, isn't it?
Well, Dave, I want to bring it back to treasuries, because U.S. treasuries are what people run to when they think they're hearing bad news. Why is that? Well, main reason is the U.S. treasury, because we're a reserve currency, is the strongest paper asset that a person can buy before they actually move to gold. Now, I want to discuss this reserve currency change that we're hearing so much about, because some of the people that we've talked to on the commentary are all for it. You know, I think about Barry Eichengreen, who wants to see a basket of currencies. But I don't think Americans really understand what it's going to feel like when the dollar is not the reserve currency of the world, standalone.
Well, it's argued more and more that no one should want to have the world's reserve currency. And it suggested that in a causal chain of financial destabilization, it is the reserve currency, in this case, the U.S. dollar, which can and should be taken to task. It's our fault,
right,
essentially.
Right.
So we discussed this directly with Barry Eichengreen. Claudio Borio at the Bank of International Settlements also likes this line of reasoning. He argues the same. And whether you agree or disagree, this is the new fad. It's the new fad in central bank circles. It's the new fad in academic circles to argue for a more egalitarian system, representative of trade flows and relative contribution to global GDP.
Well, and let's just look at history, okay? Because even though the dollar is the reserve currency today, you'd have to say the British pound was the primary reserve currency of the world for about 100 years before that. Isn't it strange, Dave, that the countries that would be considered global superpowers are also the ones that control the reserve currency? I wonder if that gets changed when you lose your reserve currency status.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, is it a mere coincidence that having the world's reserve currency occurs at the same time that a nation leads the world as a, or even the, superpower?
Mm-hmm.
And is it a coincidence that once that leadership is lost from a geostrategic standpoint, so is the reserve currency status? And which happens first? Is it you lose the reserve currency status and you lose your geostrategic advantage? I mean, these are, I think, issues worth contemplating. And the issues related to capital flows and financial stability, these are complex. I agree. I agree that instability is ingrained in a single currency fiat system. But what I would suggest is that it's the nature of fiat currency being a mere paper promise to pay, which is more important, and it's routinely overlooked because most of our academics and central bankers assume that that is actually something that has its own inherent virtues. I would look at it and say, no, that this is actually where the problem lies.
Well, yeah, here we are in America. It's good for us, but I mean, is it normal if you're number 2, number 3, number 5, number 10 on the, let's call it the G20 scale, okay, the top 20 nations? Is it normal to want to rise in pecking order a little bit in the reserve currency?
I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, if I were a country with an economy of lesser size than the U.S. economy, which is most countries, I would want a greater currency float and a larger percentage share of central bank reserve deposits. In essence, I would want to step up the usage of my currency,
right,
even as the U.S. dollar to a degree stepped down or stepped
because
back.
You can print your own, right?
Well, and what it does, it decreases the likelihood of currency panic for the non-dollar currency, whatever currency that may be, hypothetically, we're talking about here. By putting the float of currency into the hands of political decision makers versus investment and capital allocators.
Well, you remember Frieden, who you interviewed, what, 6-7 weeks ago? He said all currency decisions are political.
Right. So, I mean, that's the thing. When you look at an investment committee or someone who's allocating capital from a fiduciary standpoint, what are they looking for? Their broadest objective is profit. And if they think that's going to be put at risk, or they're not going to get their money back, or they're going to take a haircut in any way, then they move in and they move out just as fast as they moved in. So you see capital flows and currency flows as very, very fickle, as very fickle. But if you're looking at a currency being adopted as a central bank reserve asset, again, it just gives you a stable float. You know that there's X number of units of your currency out there, and it's not coming in and going out, and it doesn't create the same kind of financial disturbance as it would if it were just flowing in and just flowing out on the basis of financial opportunity or financial panic on the other side of that.
Well, and central banks love to say, do as we say, don't watch what we do, because actually you and I've talked so many times about how gold brings stability to a system. Central bankers would love to tell the populace, no, 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 fiat currency is perfectly fine. But if you look at their reserves, Dave, they're buyers of gold. I remember when they used to be sellers, but they learned that that doesn't work. And it's just interesting to see the accumulation.
I found it very curious. Ken Rogoff, in a recent Project Syndicate article, began to champion the idea of central bank accumulation of gold. I mean, again, it's just, you need to recognize it's not the normal thing for a Harvard guy, a guy who's actually one of the primary champions today of a cashless society, to be championing gold in central banks, specifically amongst emerging market central banks. And the argument is essentially, if you want to play a larger role in the global capital markets, there needs to be an additional basis for trust. Now, I'm putting this in my own words, of course, but you need to have an additional basis for trust. Gold represents trust. It represents reliability amongst central banks. So hate the stuff, as many of them do, but it's still collecting dust, as you say, in most of their vaults because they know other central banks view what they possess in ounces and in tons as a very reliable asset to have on the balance sheet.
Well, and Dave, I remember, I mean, being here 29 years, I remember all through the 1990s seeing on a monthly basis how much the central banks were divesting out of gold, and that was supposedly pushing the price down.
Well, and that actually only changed on a net basis, buying and selling. There became a net positive number in 2009. It's been positive every year since then, and it's averaging between 400 and 600 tons per year. So accumulation has been the trend by central banks since 2009. And as globalization continues down what I would view as a rockier road in future years, I think that accumulation pattern is likely to continue. And what it does is it does support, it even justifies foreign currency cooperation, the cross-holding of paper by central banks, maybe an expansion of exposure. Do I really want to own Brazilian reals today? No, not really. I mean, their currency has been in free fall for the last 2-3 years on a fairly precipitous basis. But what if the Brazilian said, look, we just, and by the way, this is hypothetical, they have not said this.
Right.
But what if they said, we're going on an accumulation program and our currency is going to be 30% backed by gold. 30% backed by gold. And we're going to have $250 billion worth of gold backing our currency by the end of 2025. Do you think that that would stabilize the real? To some degree, it would.
That's what saved other currencies in the past. We talk about the German mark when it failed back in the 1920s. How did they reestablish it? It was with gold.
And so if these emerging markets want to have a greater role in the global capital markets, no one wants to have their deposits devalued. So if I take on your currency as a deposit, it's now mine, but it's denominated in your currency. Do I want it devalued? No.
Right.
And gold goes a long way towards protecting against it, which on the one hand increases the likelihood of continued global trade. That's good. But on the other hand, it does suggest that there is something underlying, which is kind of obvious. There's concern. There's concern amongst academics and central bankers about devaluation. And the only way forward is to reestablish, is to buttress and support things that will maintain confidence and allow for continued capital flows to be there and not get nasty and ugly. Why do we move to a world of tooth and claw? We move to a world of tooth and claw when we're concerned about our own survival. Things get nasty and we get very concerned about how we preserve our own selves, self-interest, etc., when things don't go well.
Well, and when you bring up Brazil, we can talk about Argentina in the past. We could talk about what's going on in Europe, you know, in the southern states, the northern states, northern countries, rather. It all boils down to how debt is handled. And, you know, debt is handled in the long run. Too much debt is handled in two ways. You'd brought up devaluation, that's one of them, or default. You either devalue your currency, and that pays the debt off, or you default. Now, we're in a political year right now. You've got Trump talking, you've got Hillary talking, you've got Sanders talking. They all, in one way or another, are actually talking, whether they know it or not, about how they're going to handle this upcoming debt problem.
clearly we don't know who's going to be the next president of the United States. If we did, we could bet a handsome sum and make a handsome sum having a guaranteed outcome.
Yeah, but Trump says he's got a solution. How do you feel about it?
He does have a solution. I mean, he says debt is his baby. I mean, he can solve the debt problem having, you know, $20 trillion when Obama finishes his time in office. Trump's not worried about that. A billion here, a billion there. He's scrubbed his balance sheet clean more than once. He knows how to accumulate it. He knows how to handle it. He knows how to default on it. He's never worried about debt.
Yeah.
But think about that. He knows how to default on it, and it's done with ease. Mm. So I like it. I like the suggestion that he's buying back debt at a discount. That's what he's proposed. It makes sense from a business standpoint. Okay. But what's good for the debtor is, of course, bad for the creditor.
Right.
And this bad for the creditor scenario, that could be in two flavors. You have to ask yourself the question, would you be open to either one of these if you were a major creditor of the United States, if you were the Japanese government, if you were the Chinese government, if you were a member of OPEC, for instance? Either interest rates go up and the market value of the debt goes down, allowing for a cheaper settlement of the obligation. Essentially, you're buying the IOU back as the market price of that debt drops.
Which is a form of default. In a way, it's a form of deflated default or smaller default, but it's still taking one of those Ds. It's not devaluation, it's default.
But Trump's going to argue, and I think he has a point here, that's market driven. The market price goes down and you take advantage of the market price dropping.
Right.
You know, you obligated yourself at par and it traded at a premium. Now it trades at a discount and you're making a good business decision. I see that. I can tell you that our creditors would not be very happy with that. So what makes sense may not make many friends. Right. And the second option is devalue the currency and allow for a discounting of debt via the exchange rate weakness. And you just pay off your debt with cheaper fiat currency.
Which is what we've tried to do for the last 40 years. I mean, that's the plan.
But surreptitiously, you do it a paper cut at a time and ultimately you bleed out. But it's not a big deal in the immediate. It's one drop here, one drop there of very precious blood. Now, go back for a moment, because the argument is that this sort of unipolar monetary system centered on the dollar, that it is in fact destabilizing. That's the current academic argument. And it should be viewed as unattractive from an economic viewpoint because it causes global destabilization in the financial markets and whatnot. And of course, from an economic viewpoint, what do you have to do? You've got to set aside any geopolitical advantages which you may have. And those geopolitical advantages may in fact be what give you bigger and broader long-term economic advantages, but just set that aside for a minute. The nature of fiat money and allowing for debt discounting, as we looked at option two, that's the real problem.
Yeah.
The old solution for having too much debt has been perennially solved using that option.
Over and over and over. I mean, not just us. You can look at virtually any country out there.
Look at the drachma, look at the franc, look at the Italian lira. Those countries and more throughout the history. I mean, going back to the beginning of fiat currency in China, thousands and thousands of years ago, all of those countries have used the power of the printing press to alleviate the burden of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it cost them something. It cost them reputation. No longer were they considered reliable. There was a degree of trustworthiness. Look, in the pre-European Monetary Union context, everyone was always suspicious of the Italians, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese. Why? Because they were always printing. And you saw that reflected in the exchange rates as they came and were merged into the euro. You've got exchange rates relative to the German mark, which were 100 to 1, 300 to 1, 600 to 1, 1200 to 1, where they had already gone down the path of inflation.
Well, and those countries gave up the power of the printing press when they entered the European Union. You know, when they entered the monetary system that's based on the European euro, they were giving up their ability to print their way out of a problem.
Right. Well, so to become a European satellite country, it was basically, we in Brussels are going to give you lots of free stuff. We're going to be rebuilding your roads. We're going to gentrify neighborhoods in towns that are broken down and out of date. We're going to redo this electrical and that communications and, you know, various infrastructure projects. And so, yes, they were willing in the process of becoming a European satellite country to take. And at the same time, as you say, they gave up the power of the printing press. Money printing is gone, and now they have to struggle with austerity and debt negotiations. Greece is back to the negotiating table. Can you believe it? We're a stone's throw away from summer 2016, and it was the summer of 2015 that we had debt negotiations in Greece. It was the summer of 2014, 13, 12, 11. I mean, why do we still have this issue with Greece?
You can look at titles of weekly commentaries going back to about 2009. I'm just going to tell you, Dave, we need to stop using the word Greece in our titles. We're going to look like a broken record.
Well, unless it's G-R-E-A-S-E. Oh. Just let's take it a different direction altogether. I'm not a champion of the current system of fiat. I'm not a champion of breaking promises. I wish to simply point out that before we demonize a monetary system centered on the U.S. dollar and change it, a la a grand global currency reset.
Like a giant euro.
Yeah, and a significant role reshuffling, it's worth considering the benefits conferred alongside the costs that come with them. And I think what academics do today is generally look at the costs and not really talk much about the benefits. So rather than focusing on the costs alone, I suspect that the real cost of a more globally, let's put this in quotes, globally fair monetary system would be to the U.S. person, someone living on a fixed income, someone heading into retirement, someone in the middle class. This becomes very relevant. I think the real cost of moving towards a more globally fair monetary system would be to increase the cost of living for that person to the tune of 30 to 50%.
You're talking about their living standards dropping by half almost.
Yeah, because everything's more expensive. So do that, and I think you see the revolt of the masses.
Right.
Do that, and I think you head the direction. Honestly, I don't think you end up with a Trump. I don't think you end up with a Clinton-type presidency, but someone with a far nastier bent altogether. You know, this idea of strongman politics, you know, there is a way of satisfying angry people and then keeping everyone in mind. Let me give you one historical example. Tito. If you make the people angry enough, they'll ask for a strongman and then be stuck with a strongman.
Right.
I think Trump is a small shadow of what we might end up getting if we end up with a massive inflationary problem.
Well, you know, Dave, our country was built on states, and states had certain rights. Obviously, you and I are talking federally here. We're talking about people revolting as masses. But I remember about 3 years ago, you were in Austin, and there was a guy who was campaigning in Texas, a guy named Greg Abbott, and he came out and actually talked to you before your conference. He had something going on in the room next door, and you guys talked about gold, and he said, I like gold. And what we're seeing now, that man ultimately was elected governor of Texas, Governor Greg Abbott, and we're starting to see legislation come through in Texas that has to do with secession. We're talking legislation coming through and requests to the Federal Reserve to bring back $1 billion worth of gold from the Federal Reserve depositories. You're starting to see some action right now from a state level that might be similar to this revenge of the masses.
I've met a lot of politicians, and most of them practice sincerity, whether they mean it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them seem friendly, but that's sort of in campaign mode. And Greg struck me as just a genuinely interesting and good human being.
Yeah.
Far from perfect. That would describe me, you, and probably everybody else on the planet.
But there was a relaxed way about him when you guys were talking.
I think he was just genuinely sincere, genuinely mm-hmm. friendly, genuinely curious. Politicians often want to talk. And if you give them a mic, if you give them the limelight, they just, I mean, you try to get the mic back, to try to shift someone else into the limelight or get them out of it. It doesn't happen.
But he asked you questions.
He asked me questions, yeah. Which is very, I thought it was interesting. But you're right. Back to this issue in Texas, it's intriguing to watch Texas be proactive. They're discussing their resources. They're discussing controlling their resources outside the purview of the federal government. And the proposed bullion depository, we brought this up maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, but it's firmly supported by Greg Abbott. It speaks to me to a core issue. Beyond having a depository in Texas, I don't even know if that makes sense. But what it speaks to me is the core issue in play for the last 10 to 15 years, which is an erosion of trust and a growing suspicion of the political elite. And I guess you could say the political elite, I think you could say the Wall Street and banking elite, where people just say, look, I want a little bit more control. And taking control is what people do when fear and distrust reign. So the idea of having liquid assets that are not in the vast system of bank liabilities and counterparty risk, When does that become a priority? It becomes a priority when those counterparties become suspect.
Well, let me ask you. Okay, is bringing back the bullion, Texas's bullion from New York back down to Texas, is it a symbolic move or is it more of a practical move?
Well, I mean, it may be as simple as this. Maybe we don't know all the reasoning. It could be that, you know, HSBC gets slapped with all kinds of fines for money laundering. This goes back a few years. But you just think, gosh, who am I working with? Who's storing my gold?
Right.
Do they still have it? And maybe you say to yourself, we're paying them a lot of money to store them and not sure we even like them, right? Certainly don't like the way they've conducted business in other areas. So is it a symbolic gesture? Could be. I'll tell you what, it's not a sum that's large enough to be anything more than symbolic today. You look at the revenues in the state of Texas, you look at the budget in the state of Texas, and this is minuscule compared to everything that's going on in one of the most vibrant states in the country. Of course, they're in tough times or tougher times today with oil and natural gas being on their backs. But it does make you wonder about what the state leadership wants. What kind of bargaining chips are they organizing? What's down the pike where if they have to give this up, it's for something else? The discussion of secession, maybe this goes back since the beginning of the state.
Yeah.
They kept it open. They always keep it open. Every time I see my in-laws, it's always an option. It's written in their state constitution, and they're the only state that still has that in the state constitution.
Really? That's the only state that still has it in
there? They only signed on with the understanding that they could sign out and walk away anytime they chose, right? But there is secession conversations occurring again in the Texas legislature. And so maybe this is just rumblings and saber rattling and everything else. It makes me wonder which straw is the straw that breaks the camel's back. When you think about the impact of taking gold out of a system where so much of that gold has been leased, has been lent out, has been double, triple, quadruple counted. In the case of COMEX, where we were talking earlier, it's not a quintuple counting. 542-1, that's a very significant issue. And it comes back to that question of when? When? Because right, it may be Texas asking for their $600, $700 million worth of gold to be shipped, and all of a sudden HSBC says, well, we'd like to comply, but we can't.
Right.
Is that it? I don't know.
Well, we've seen this before. I mean, we have seen Germany ask for their gold and be told that it's going to take 7 years, even for a fraction of what they supposedly have here. So, yeah, there are some things that threaten what you would consider the trust of the system. Another thing that's showing a threat, though, Dave, is, strangely enough, Saudi Arabia, now that they're threatened with possibly being fingered for 9/11, the September 11th attacks, they've come out and said, look, that's fine. We'll just go ahead and pull our treasuries. This is a play of a movie that we actually saw back in the late 70s called Rollover, where if Saudi Arabia just sold all their treasuries or didn't roll them over, didn't buy them again, you could see the collapse of the U.S. dollar.
You have to understand the McIlvany family, and this is sort of under the Don McIlvany leadership, never been fond of Jane Fonda.
Right.
But very intrigued by the storyline in Rollover.
That was a movie that the family saw at least once.
I think between Rollover, Red Dawn, and a half a dozen Chuck Norris movies, there were sort of the staples growing up. And my dad had sort of a love-hate relationship with Rollover. One, because he loved the story, but two, he just couldn't stand Jane Fonda.
Well, and the story was the Saudis had a gun to our head because they were the ones who bought the U.S. treasuries.
That's right. They were not going to continue to finance our deficits. And, you know, here in recent weeks, they've threatened to sell $750 billion worth of treasuries and other U.S. dollar assets if we open up a liability to the Saudis, the royal family, the government, for 9/11. And, you know, we now have this week in a Freedom of Information Act request, the Treasury releases the official Saudi holdings as if to say, are you threatening us? Did you say $750 billion? Because at our last count, and just so you know, we have, at your request, not shared this number for 40 years, but we are today sharing it because some citizen in the United States requested that we do so. You don't have $750 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. You have $116 billion, and that represents roughly 20% of your reserves. Well, under the global average, let me ask this question again. Were you threatening us?
I mean, yeah, because the global average is, what, 50 or 60% of other countries holding treasuries.
And there is so much going on in the Middle East right now that I'd love to be privy to. You've got Al-Naimi, the oil minister who is canned. That just doesn't happen, okay? So Al-Naimi's been there. He's been a force to be reckoned with, and he gets fired. Kerry's visiting this week. The FBI is keeping under wraps over 80,000 secret files on the Saudis and 9/11. And I don't know. Maybe it's time for another Freedom of Information Act request. But what is perfectly clear, while there's not a lot clear because I'm not in Riyadh, what is perfectly clear is that the Saudis and other foreign states have shifted from treasury accumulation to treasury distribution. And anything we do on the fiscal front here in the United States is going to be hampered by our ability to finance it, you know, or perhaps at a zero interest rate world. We'll see how that works out. This is the interesting parallel. Think about this. You've had a distribution trend for gold for 4 years, and now it's beginning to be accumulated. A treasury accumulation trend, which is now shifted in the direction of distribution. Do you see some shifts occurring in some fundamental asset classes that are supposed to both represent safety?
Remember what we talked about last week with your dad, what he talked about, the double run in a banking system. That double run is the final phase, whether it's the banking system or what we're talking about right now is the worldwide reserve system, where people are going out of the reserve currency. We're seeing this by the billion right now, and into physical metal.
Well, what is curious, I mean, when you think about Mark Spitznagel's comments this last week where, you know, markets don't have a purpose anymore. They just reflect whatever central planners want them to.
Right. We've seen the manipulations.
It just, that cuts through so much garbage. Markets don't have a purpose anymore. They reflect whatever central banks want them to, was his comment. And you look and you say, okay, well, this is a strange world. We live in a zero rate world where investors look at our nearly 2% nominal yield on 10-year treasuries. And you compare that to negative rates elsewhere in the world. And, you know, how is it that, do you remember that old phrase, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed Jack is king? I mean, treasuries may still attract people on the basis of having a positive yield. And yet Spitznagel's comment, but who's attracted and who's doing the buying? Is the Fed buying from the Treasury directly? Are we doing direct monetization and maintaining a facade of the market? Because the market is gone.
Right.
The market is gone.
Right. Well, and talking about interest rates, I think the United States is one of the only countries left in the world that's actually paying positive rates.
When you're looking at U.S. paper, that's all debt instruments. We are 60% of all positive yielding paper in the world. And if you include things that mature in 1 year or less, the U.S. represents 89% of all positively yielding paper.
We're the last guys in the game.
We are the last guys in the game. So it's a bit confusing. Is this the end of the dollar or the beginning of the dollar regime just on new terms? We had the Bretton Woods era. We've had the post-Bretton Woods era. We know that we have discontent among the G20 for how things are centered on the U.S. dollar. And yet, look at us. If you're allocating assets and looking for a positive yield, we're just about the only place that you can go. We live in very interesting times.
Over the last couple of years, we've seen the hedge fund managers doing what we're talking about, which is moving away from paper, starting to reaccumulate gold. We've seen the central banks over the last 4, 5, 6 years decreasing their paper and increasing their gold. We're seeing Saudi Arabia and the other countries who would normally be buying treasuries, at least not rebuying as many treasuries, but they're accumulating gold. And so I guess this is probably an easy question to answer, Dave, but for the person who's seeing these things, what should they be doing?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. When Paul Singer, when Stanley Druckenmiller, I mean, their first comments are always, look, stocks are really overpriced. So what are your options? So you decide stocks are overpriced and you want to get out, quote unquote. Where do you go? If you move to U.S. dollar cash, you're asking Janet Yellen, Evans, Fisher, Dudley, Brainard, all the crew at the Federal Reserve to manage your assets for you. And a professional asset manager says to themselves, I grant you, they're all PhDs, but I would prefer to manage my money than give it to them. And central banks, by the way, don't have a very good long-term track record. So what are your options? So Druckenmiller says, well, yeah, my largest cash position is in ounces today. What is he saying? He's saying that he has opted out of stocks for a very good reason, because fundamentally they're overpriced.
And he's opted out of cash for a very good reason.
He's opted out of central bank management for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
That says it all, right? That says it all. You do want to lower your risk profile in terms of equity allocations. You do want to recognize that the bond market, to some degree, is a rigged game until it quits being a rigged game. So you've got low rates, not on the basis of low risk, but on the basis of heavy-handedness by the Fed. And it's this heavy-handedness, this control in the marketplace, which has many market practitioners saying, I'm not sure I want to play because it's no longer being driven by normal cause and effect. We don't even know what basis to make decisions on because, again, it's the arbitrary decisions of a committee.
Central bank perception management.
So what do you do? Yeah, you do need to move to cash. Yeah, but to be in only cash and have Yellen, Evans, Fisher, Dudley, Brainerd, and the rest of them manage your money is a bad idea. So you hedge that bet, too, with a metals portfolio, gold, silver, platinum, what have you, just to say, look, I like cash, but I don't like the people managing it. So I've hedged that bet.
Yeah. And you call that cash as well.
Right. Because ultimately, what purpose does it serve? It serves this purpose, the same as every kind of cash. At the right moment, in the right context, you look at value and you say, I want to put this to work for me. I'm going to spend my cash on what I consider to be a reasonable value when that value proposition presents itself and it's compelling. I can't tell you, as challenging as I think the next 2 to 4 years are going to be, I am more excited now than I have been in any time I've worked in the professional money management field. You know why? Because the opportunities, we're on the cusp of a once-in-a-generation opportunity, a wealth transfer that occurs when assets get very, very inexpensive. And the question is, do you have liquidity? And do you have a liquidity in the most reliable form? And yes, that does mean devoid of counterparty risk. Okay, that is important. That's imperative. And if you can answer those questions, I think the next 3-4 years are absolutely thrilling for you instead of terrifying.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.